Hello and welcome to episode 91 of the Creating Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast. I'm Marsh Davis. I'm joined on this very special, election special, in fact, Creating Crowbar episode, by a coalition of chaos. Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Yes.
Days, merely days before the nation is stolen in a terrible coup by insert party name here, and which will ruin everything forever.
Or the day this goes out. The world will be different.
Indeed,
Who knows? Actually, what will actually have happened is that no one will have decided anything, and there'll be about a week at least of people making special deals.
But we can all rest assured that Parliament will eventually be filled by some shrieking Jebends. Yes.
Let me be abundantly clear.
Please be clear. I don't think you're clear enough. Can you be clearer?
Let me be abundantly clear.
That's an excellent question, Chris. I'm really glad you asked that.
But what about hard-working families?
Abundantly clear?
I think for our American listeners, there's an election on in the UK. And British elections are the most boring elections you can possibly imagine. So...
Really?
That's what... Well...
Yeah, oh, well, all the talk speak that is made with the people's mouths and stuff is terrible.
6 weeks of pointless rhetoric and then... Anyway, so that's why we escape into video games.
Yes.
On a daily basis.
Talking of which, you've been escaping into a very violent video game.
And an altogether different political landscape.
Yes.
Although one that UKIP have forgotten about. Wolfenstein The Old Blood, which is the standalone expansion.
Expandalone, I believe.
Expandalone. Let me be abundantly clear. It's just a game that costs £15. It's littler than a bigger game. So you call it an expansion, but it isn't really. It's a little game. Which is the, so it's a add-on thing for Wolfenstein, The New Order.
Set before the events of The New Order, right?
Yeah. So it's called The Old Blood, and it's set in 1946, which is...
But it feels like it was made in 1995.
Yeah. Which is sort of like, right, and it's a prologue to... it's a prologue to the prologue of The New Order, because The New Order also opens in 1946, and then that's just for the opening, and then it rapidly progresses to its sort of alt-future 60s.
Yeah. Actually, no, that was harsh of me to say it was made in 1995, because shooters were good then. It was made in the terrible era of the wasteland of shooters.
See, you skipped ahead of it.
Sorry,
But, like, because it's very reminiscent of the, of Return to Castle Wolfenstein in the first case. And to a lesser extent of Raven's 2009 Wolfenstein game. And altogether, that era of shooters from like in the early noughties, the sort of post Half-Life, pre Modern Warfare, when these things were kind of like, you know, free roaming sort of adventure shooty games with sort of interspersed with set pieces and with very similar kind of rhythm and a very similar
turret
kind of
sections. Lots of fucking turret sections.
Stealth bits.
Mini-bosses.
And so on. And yeah, so it's set, you know, it's basically just the story of BJ Blazkowicz setting out to find the location of the base that you're invading at the beginning of the New Order. So that's its sort of chief tie-in. And this is an excuse to go to Castle Wolfenstein, which wasn't in the New Order, and some other places, and to far more, like, the Old Blood is written on the logo like a kind of Hammer Horror kind of VHS. And that's what it's going for this time. It brings the occult stuff that's always been associated with Wolfenstein, like, back into it, which was something that was... it was in the New Order, but it arrived in a different way. And it was presented very differently to the sort of traditional, you know, gothic horror stuff that series has done with, you know, big edifice, you know, with undead and, you know, gruesome castles and all the rest of it. What the New Order did with that stuff was really, really different and kind of cool because it was different. And that is the nature of why this is sort of a strange direction to have taken it in, because this feels like the kind of capable and workmanlike new Wolfenstein game that you'd get before somebody revolutionizes it by setting it in a new place and applying loads of new design sensibilities to it and showing you something new. And as a result, it's sort of weirdly underwhelming because it can't do anything that's bigger or more novel than what the game that it's spinning off already did. You know, minor spoilers for The New Order, like it can't do anything near as big as going to the moon. Or exploring what Nazi Berlin looks like 20 years after the Nazis win the war. or any of those kind of things that...
I don't think it's problems, or the problems of setting, though, specifically. Do you think that's what's limiting it? I think it's just very mechanically circumscribed in really obvious ways.
I think it is as well, but I think that, you know, the New Order isn't a complicated game.
Hmm.
Like, and there are bits in, there are set pieces in The Old Blood that are perfectly good and on par with what was good about, the New Order. I'm getting confused because of the myriad titles.
Yeah.
But the lack of a substantial kind of what's next factor, I think, prevents the moments where it is good from feeling like an advancement on the previous game. You know, like even, you know, because it's got a whole new sort of array of weapons with, obviously, with some direct parallels to the previous game because it's set in a different era, it's set in the 40s. So, yeah. And that just means that the weapons are worse, generally. there's a bolt action rifle that I like. It's quite gratifying.
And kind of like the single shot grenade launcher thing.
Yeah, the single shot sort of flare gun grenade launcher is cool. Later you get a sawn off shotgun, which is quite gratifying. But compared to the kind of like, you know, modular laser weapons and, sort of the other stuff that the New Order did, it has nothing to add there.
Mm.
And otherwise, it relies on a linear series of, combat challenges that expose, I think, in how kind of prescribed they are, as you say, expose some of the weaknesses of, or at least it does things that the game it's based on doesn't do with the same kind of frequency. For example, the usually the strongest encounters of Wolfenstein, the bits where the game the machine game is made out of it comes to life is when you have the sort of something that starts off as a stealth section.
Hmm.
When you have like multiple commanders in an area. And if you sound the alarm while either of the commanders is still alive, you face waves of enemies until you can silence the alarm by killing the commanders. And because the game works, A, as a perfectly capable stealth shooter, and B, as a really good, you know, sort of balls out action game, you can segue between those states, relatively fluidly. Mm-hmm. And The Old Blood has, certain bits of map design, which I think has bigger stealth enhancers than the New Order does, especially later on.
Oh, really? Okay. Like,
you're nowhere near it. Like,
right.
But that comes after, one, a forced linear initial stealth sequence.
Yeah.
A series of stealth sequences, which just goes on a little bit too long. Like, some of the bits are actually all right, and some of the bits are quite gratifying to solve. But when that ends...
Pulling a face here.
I mean, I thought it was fine. Like, it took me 20 minutes to get through it, and then it's done. But, like...
Yeah. It's 20 minutes in which I could have been living, though, Chris. I could have been running free on the moors, naked.
Rather than doing bellowing. Stealth things against big lumbering monsters you have to wait to walk past.
Yeah, there's no challenge to it. You can see exactly what you need to do, and the only factor that's involved in it is just waiting and then doing the thing you need to do. If you don't do the thing you need to, you might as well just restart.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well...
I think there's a lot of stealth games that were, like, games that are entirely about stealth that fall into that exact same class.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think Wolfenstein The New Order got away with it. Because, you know, it didn't do that. It specifically had areas which had a huge amount of breadth to them, and a lot of kind of, as Chris said, you could segue from one kind of style of play into another.
Mm.
And this, it doesn't seem that it's, at least in the first hour or so, very inflexible. When it starts to introduce the new, that mechanic where you have commanders that you've got to take down, but other, and if you don't take them down, it calls...
That's not a new mechanic.
No, sorry, I don't know why I said new. It's because it's new in the title. The old mechanic from the new game.
Yeah.
Even in that circumstance, it places the a commander at either end of a linear thing. So I really have no choice but to kind of just run a gauntlet.
Weirdly, that's not true yet for you, but because I know you're up to. You're up to the boat, right?
There's one instance of that so far. Really? But
I definitely didn't encounter that, but then it really does happen.
Yeah.
I definitely like aced stealthed all the bits up until a particular part later on.
Oh no, it's not a force fail. You can get through it and you can still stealth it, but the thing is, there's no point. Because one of the things, your objective is to kill the commander lest he summons reinforcements.
But he's at the
end of the level. I don't know why that seems very unsatisfying to me. It's more interesting when you take out the commanders, then mop up the forces. That makes sense. If the commander's one of the last things you do, then it's just presented to you a linear path, which you don't have any choice but to approach in the same way. Like, it's presented the kind of possibility of stealth, but ultimately it's just what you have to do, you know? There's no choice involved.
No choice not to stealth it.
Well, you, yeah, I mean, well, no, I suppose you can just shoot up the place, yeah. But...
Oh, like, I do see what you're saying. So one of the problems it gives you later on, sorry, this is such a complicated thing, because I thought you were going to say something, then I realised you went up to the bit that I was going to complain about for doing that, even because I don't think earlier, which is weird, because I agree with you, but don't agree with you in that instance, but like...
Also, some of the logic in it seems janky about whether people see you or not. Mm. More so, I never encountered that in... that's fucking annoying. The old game's called the New Order. I never encountered that in the New Order. But this time, like, quite a few times, like, I've killed somebody and the alarms have gone off and then suddenly everybody knows where I am. I'm just like,
there are new guys that take two headshots to kill, but the first headshot makes them fall over and you think they're dead and then they get up and sound the alarm. I've noticed that happened a couple of times, so that might have been...
No, it was a stealth kill.
Oh, okay, then no, I don't know.
I know, anyway.
But yeah, so it does, it'll do a stealth section like that, but then it'll have an instance where you're just seen, it's a gunfight now.
Mm.
And the original game does do that. The original game does have, but it presents it, it gives it, I think the whole thing has a bit more time to breathe, and it gives, you kind of know why this is something you might feasibly stealth, whereas the next bit, the enemies are going to be alert when you enter the room. Whereas it can feel a bit corridor to corridor arbitrary in the old blood, you'll kind of do stealth one bit, and then the next bit, you'll run out, and there'll just be like a line of dudes, and you'll gun them down because they start out having seen you. But then later on, there are far more linear stealth encounters as well, where it'll throw in. There's a new enemy it's a variant on the big slow moving orange shotgun dudes from the New Order, like a proto version of them, which can't be stealth killed at all. And it'll throw in the two headshot regular guys and a few other enemies. And it basically makes it so that unless you really, really wait it out, you kind of have to sound the alarm because there's no stealth way to take down the guys. And they'll often be standing right in looking at you. So it sort of forces, at least a few encounters with, the alarm getting set off. The game's strength, I think, is it can survive that because it's often better as a shooter, straight shooter. Sorry, I didn't actually mean to correct you on the stealth thing. I kind of get what you're saying.
I didn't explain that very well. What I meant is that, usually you present a situation, you get two commanders, you take them out, then you mop up the troops. In this, because the commander's at the end, you kind of kill all of his friends, and then you kill him, and you're like, oh, well, now I don't... Now that the kind of tactical advantage I have is moot. Rather than moot.
There's a few instances of that. I still find that kind of arena combat thing gratifying. Like, and when it does that, it does it fine. And it transitions between that and a few other things that work pretty well. Like there's a kind of last stand defense moment that I thought works. There's some boss fight stuff, and then it transitions really dramatically into being a very different type of game. A game that the original game wasn't at all with the occult stuff, and it's a shame in a way because that should be an opportunity to show off what's kind of good and still kind of doom-like about its kind of gratifying weapons and things, but it really just comes off as dated.
Huh.
Like, it's types of encounters that you have played through before. Like, I don't want to necessarily spoil too much about where that story goes.
Well,
but no. They've shown stuff in the trailers as well, and like, but...
Well, this kind of like, I have to say, I was quite pleasantly surprised by the lore items that I've found so far. You know, little snippets of information about kind of machine beasts in the depths and things like that. It does sound kind of, it's got a nice twist on the... No? Okay.
I think I'm right at the end, but I haven't finished yet. With that in mind, I don't want to spoil too much. It's take on what would necessarily be occult, or like, it's take on Nazi occultism. Is exactly the one that's been done before. Like 100% exactly the same. Like it's not new. It's old. And
old blood.
Especially at the beginning. Like maybe they throw something in, but like their vague gestures are something more Lovecraftian. No. Nope.
Do you like the kind of small amount of dialoguing and stuff that's in there between like NPCs and stuff? I thought that was okay.
Yeah, there's some really it's confusing because I don't know whether it's just because he sounds more like him or because I played it recently, but BJ Blazkowicz is played by Brian Bloom, who plays Varric in Dragon Age, and he's accompanied at the beginning of the game by a very softly spoken Welshman Who, I don't know if it's the same actor, but he sounds an awful lot like Solas from Dragon Age, to such an extent that it really threw me at the beginning. And I hear, and as a result, I'd never really heard Varric in BJ Blazkowicz in each other before, but now I really do. And like, there are moments where it's just like, you know, it's just this kind of like, you know, the homespun Nazi slaying wisdom of a dwarf with a crossbow. Like, there are some amazing, well, the other thing I was going to say about it is, I think the one of the reasons I love the New Order is it runs this line where it's sort of slightly over melodramatic or over earnest, and then obviously tongue in cheek, and it keeps it in this sort of weird suspension where you're not sure which way it wants you to go. And I think it actually works for that game. Like, you don't know when it's trying to be funny or not. And, you know, when it's kind of big and Tarantino-esque in its characterization of its villains and stuff, it kind of figures, it works.
Do you not think that was successful this time? I quite like the villains in it so far.
It has a moment which is, well, it has two moments which are very, very, very similar.
Yeah, that's probably why I liked it.
To moments from the, to the New Order. Including a bit where you have to carry a tray so that a female high-ranking Nazi can characterize at you.
Right.
Right, and it's like, this is obviously a reference, but it's like, it's the same trick, and it really shouldn't be. They've proven that they can do this sort of cinematic Tarantino-esque stuff, so why not do something different than doing exactly the same set piece again?
Yeah. I thought there were some good character beats in the introduction. You've got, obviously, Blazkowicz is dressed up as an SS officer in the opening moments and trying to get into Kafel Wurzelsbler. And, he can't speak German, as I can't speak English, apparently. You know, he's practicing it. It's kind of funny, because he sounds completely lame. Guten Morgen.
Yeah. So, yeah, that, like, there are good bits, and this is what I'm going to say about it is, it's still Wolfenstein, and there are some, like, really Wolfenstein-y lines of dialogue in it, like, don't you fucking drown, you adorable tosspot, is something someone yells at BJ Blazkowicz at one point.
I really like the Welsh guy as well. He's an extremely boring man. I was thinking, God, he starts talking
gently about Snowdonia.
Yes, and then gets dragged out of the room. Yeah. Like, oh, thank God.
And BJ's kind of musings are still kind of like, they almost play the musing for laughs at one point. Yeah, like, there's a bit where, like, sees an apron or something, and he goes like,
this is evoking memories of my childhood in really elaborate metaphors.
He says, my cousin Willie had a diner. I made my first dollar in that diner. I spent it all on rock candy. Sweet, sweet candy. and it's like, where did that come from? There's a bit where a character asks him, like, you know, what's your name? And he says, you know, Lieutenant William J. Blazkowicz, and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, what do people call you? And he says, well, my father called me Billy Boy. Like, that is a name for a child. Well, most people call me BJ. And she goes, you look like a BJ. To which he responds, well, thanks. And it's like, as close as they've ever got to making that joke. And it's like, but then it goes on to do the most earnest, like, aren't the Nazis really awful in terms of the way they've made us all suffer? Like, and I think the original thread of that line, I don't know, it's definitely set, it's pop culture Nazi land. And actually, weirdly, the settings that you go to are far less, weirdly, less believable than the New Order. Because the New Order feels like it might have once looked like the real world, and someone's planted this sort of Nazi brutalist concrete metropolis on top of it, which is the way the art design worked. In the Old Blood, after, you know, Castle Wolfenstein, which is a lot of what you'd expect from Castle Wolfenstein in terms of this sort of sheer gothic techno Nazi citadel thing, there's a village, which is ostensibly a village in Germany that previously wasn't particularly notable in 1946. And it could be in Skyrim. Like, it is this sort of like, gentle sort of, you know, Saxon hamlet with, like, you know, ye olde pub signs and thatched roofs and, you know, fishing nets in, you know, by the riverfront on little wooden jetties. And it's like, nowhere looked like this in 1946 at all. Like, it's cartoon Hammer horror Nazi village, right? Like, if you go up the hill to the castle, that's where Dracula lives. Like, that's where they've set the second half of it. And I don't know, for some reason, like, because it is flown off the handle that far in the direction of, and then obviously occult stuff. Because it flies off the handle that far in the direction of the absurd, the kind of, the musings on families taken by the Nazis, and, you know, it throws in a group of Jewish characters as well, and then the original, the New Order, includes, you know, sort of, you know, the, it does some things that are arguably problematic with the particular, you know, the reasons for the persecution of the Jewish faith by the Nazis. But it ties it into a whole that is at least, it feels like one coherent piece of fiction, whereas this, I think, feels more all over the place, because it's like old Wolfenstein, where it's little villages and big gothic castles and scary monsters, mixed with the new Wolfenstein's attempt to do, like, moments of genuine human tragedy.
Mm.
And I think it, whatever knife-edge balance they might strike for the first one, it just wobbles too far either side of it this time. Which is a shame, because it's still a good shooter, like, it's still a capable shooting game, and it's, this feels like a 7 out of 10 from 2004.
Mm.
Which is weird. It feels like there should be a different dimension, like a parallel dimension to this one that we live in, where, like, last year, Machine Games made this kind of workaday Wolfenstein game, and everyone's like, why did they make this? It's just a bit like, it's better than Raven's one, but it's not amazing. And then they've just come out with this mind-blowing expansion where they set it in like the 60s, and it's really weird, and they record all these Beatles songs, and they go off the rails with it, and everyone's celebrating how they've thrown the old rules out. But this is different. This is like, I don't know.
They've thrown the rules in. But
yeah, it's the second half of Skyfall problem.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to persist with it, to be honest. I'm a bit, there's a gunboat section in. It's an on-rails gunboat section.
Yeah.
I'm just like, well, surely we're past this now as a species.
But Marsh, I mean, you have to realise, see, there's those guys with the heavy machine gun emplacements, but there's that red barrel next to them.
I know, huge and red barrels.
If you shoot the red barrel, you don't have to kill the machine gun guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where they get these ideas.
This definitely makes me not want to play this, but want to replay the New Order.
Yeah, the Order's great.
And also to persuade someone to release BJ Blazkowicz voice packs for every game, where I just hear Blazkowicz's thoughts on things in the environment and how they relate to his childhood. Yeah. As I'm playing Half-Life 2 or anything.
It opens with, like, I mean, he's good at the irrelevant monologue the best of times, but, like, in the New Order, his sort of, like, his sort of end-of-the-world mumblings makes sense in a way, because at the beginning of the game starts with this last-ditch attempt to prevent the Nazis from winning the war. And so it does have this sort of apocalyptic stakes. And then in the future he subsequently wakes up to, the Nazis have won the war, and his kind of, like, you know, his musings on what's been lost kind of makes some sense. He has the same character in this, but the war hasn't been lost yet. So he's just sitting there, like, you know, the beginning of the game, he's asleep in the back of a car, going like, I hear the howling of the dead, and I'm coming home. And he's just having a kip in a car to say, and then he subsequently refuses to believe that the war's been lost, whereas his apocalyptic musings sort of seem to indicate otherwise.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The old meh.
You've been playing something that isn't meh?
So it's very not meh.
What's that song?
Amazing. It's a Kerbal Space Program.
That's not a new game.
It's not a new game. It's one of these games where its release is just incidental to its, you know, ongoing existence. It's been around for years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to have reached 1.0, I don't know, last week or something. And it's still as amazing as it was a week ago for all the same reasons. But everyone should play it nonetheless. It's a game about building your own spaceships. Essentially, there is a campaign and stuff, but really it's just one of the most satisfying and sandbox games you could ever play, really. It's about building your own rocket ships out of various parts and manipulating the physics of the universe itself to achieve things you want to achieve.
Hmm.
The learning curve of the Kerbal Space Program maps to your understanding of how things move through the cosmos in a way that is so satisfying. I love Sims at the best of times, but the Kerbal Space Program is a simulation of one of the some of the finest endeavours that our species has ever accomplished technologically. Like the ability to put things into space and to send them off to distant parts of the universe. And you look at Kerbal Space Program, it looks like kind of a kid's game, really. It's not an especially beautiful game, though it is beautiful, actually, when you play it. The textures are flat. There's no kind of big, fancy, you know, lens flare going on there. It's just the very functional graphics. But the thing it's simulating, and the thing that you, that it draws you into complete use, is the fantasy of, striking out into the final frontier, in a way that feels realistic, because it is based on real science. It's based on, you know, how orbits work and how, you know, deceleration and acceleration changes orbits and the way you slingshot your way around gravity wells to get to places. And it gives you just the slightest hint of how difficult it is to land on the moon. The kind of the precision involved and the kind of the enormous amount of planning that goes into the creation of your spaceship and every little maneuver that happens as you go along. And it's an absolutely tremendous achievement.
Would you recommend people coming to it now playing the sandbox mode rather than the career, or there's another mode, I forget what it's called?
I think personally, I'm still like struggling to get into the career mode because...
Yeah, I tried it and couldn't really make any headway in it because the tutorials don't really cover any of the basic stuff that you need to know.
The campaign greatly limits the number of pieces you start with.
Yeah.
And I think the best way to get into that game is to play the tutorials, which is separate from the campaign, and then go into Sandbox and just build things that can get into orbit and just mess around and, you know.
You see, I assume the career mode would ease me into it, but then it actually just puts... I think maybe it's not really designed to introduce you to the game so much as a kind of additional layer of complexity for people who've already had fun and worked
challenge.
Out the Sandbox.
That's weird, because I learned Kerbal entirely through the career mode. I've never played Sandbox.
Okay.
I played the tutorials. I didn't get on with them really.
Well, the thing is, the tutorials teach you about orbital mechanics, but you know what you really want to know is best practice for building a spaceship.
I think that's always going to be stuff that there's a mixture of trial and error, and it's again one of the things like trial and error. Look at wikis and guides to learn the basics, but I always restricted myself from looking at other people's builds. I didn't want building guides. I wanted to know. You know, how do I actually achieve orbit in principle? So I try and figure out the chance to do it. But I actually really like the career mode because limiting the parts you get prevents you from, one, it forces you to start off smaller.
Well, the career mode means something different than it did earlier in the development, weirdly. So I don't know.
I've played both. And the new one is just the development of what was the old career mode. Basically, you get science and funding, and you have to build and expand your spaceport and research new parts and buy new parts and do jobs, basically testing parts in different conditions and all that stuff. The thing the career mode does that I think works really well is, it's not just, you know, it adds goals separate to the obvious ones. The obvious ones being get in space, then get into orbit, then get in orbit something else, then land on something else and all that stuff. There's stuff like it'll ask you to check it to test a certain kind of booster rocket, but at altitude, and that means activating it at altitude, which means that you've got to do something weird, like lift something that's designed to be a liftoff rocket, like a starter rocket. You have to try and get that into space or high up so that you can then fire it.
Oh.
And those challenges, you might be right that it's like a gated challenge for after you've learned the mechanics, but I find that's really helpful because it teaches you to think about the stuff that really matters, which is basically just weight, propulsion and stability. And to learn how to reconfigure those things in different parts. And then you can sort of transfer those lessons.
I think I'm going to cope with that stuff. I just didn't know how to run a space station.
There's a lot of stuff that...
Not space station. You know what I mean? What's the ground agency. Thing? Agency, there you go.
Yeah, there's stuff like the order, building the order at which things fire on your rocket is super important. And the interface for it is actually brilliant. But it doesn't teach you anything about the interface in the campaign. So learning that you can build these little rings that detach part of your ships when you press spacebar, and you design this beautiful series of spacebar presses to get into orbit that shares part of your craft and things like that. That's stuff that is just pure trial and error. But it's not trial and error of just building rockets, which is really fun. It's trial and error of just clicking on bits of the interface until you find out what does what. And that isn't a satisfying sort of development. It is trial and error, but the joy of the game is trying and failing and there's an instant restart button.
The font is too small. Just going to say that. The font's too small. You can't change the size of the font. Zero out of ten.
Yeah.
Zero out of ten.
I agree with that. At high resolutions, yeah. It shrinks the entire interface. The high you get the res.
You can change the UI. You just can't change the font size in any of the descriptions. But it's only been in development for a fucking billion years, so why would they fix that?
It is beautiful, though. There's an amazing sense of travel to when you're, the sense of, I don't know how it achieves this sense of distance when you've actually gone super high up into the, like, the very edge of the stratosphere, and you pan the camera to look down, and you see, like, the trail of your smoke just going down in a faint spiral all the way down to your base, which has just become this, like, dot on the ground. That sense of just moving through huge amounts of space is incredible. Not many games have achieved that, really. Hmm. And to know that it's a thing that you've built as well, that it's your baby that's going up there. I also love the tone of it. I think the tone of it is just absolutely spot on. It's a thing that is complicated, but could teach kids, like, really important principles. And totally, like, your kerbals can die and stuff, and it's kind of, you fear for them. Like, they're in terrifying situations. But the having these kind of cute cartoon characters be there with you in these moments of peril just makes it so accessible. I kind of really respect that, actually, about it.
How many kerbals have died to serve your greedy need to get to the stars?
I didn't really understand how to deploy parachutes for a long time in the campaign. Right. But you have a limited stable of kerbals in the campaign.
Stable?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't refer to them as horses. Yeah. I deploy as space horses, I send off. But yeah, I kill them all off really quickly and realise they're all dead.
Something that got added in the last couple of patches, which I really like, is you can customize difficulty to quite a fine degree, which they, you know, for example, preventing kerbals from respawning, which they do normally, and for example, switching off quick loading and quick save. So you actually have to own your decisions. You can play almost in the roguelike mode.
Oh, wow.
Where you can run out, if you kill enough kerbals, your reputation dips, you run out of money, you get shuttered. And that's, like, again, works. Like, I think probably the genius of that game is it works as a sandbox, build what you want game, but it also works as a kind of management strategy game with a heavy engineering element. Which is probably what you do when you know what you're doing. And it's like, you can't afford to fuck up, because if you fuck up and you lose somebody, that actually you've lost them then. Like, that stuff's really, really up to how you want to play it, which I think is probably the genius of the thing. It's also an amazing modding scene, which is kind of, I guess, one of the things that have benefit of being a 4-year-old game that has always openly supported modding, is that the asking price for that game isn't just Kerbal Space Program, right? It's that Kerbal Space Program and every, like, oh, I can fix this about it idea of someone's had over the course of 4 years.
Get those mods before you have to pay for them.
Last week's topical hot take returns.
Yes.
What have you been playing, Marty?
I've been playing another game with physics simulation, although albeit on a much lower scale. I've been playing a game called Ex Anima, which, for the purpose of clarification, I should say, I really quite like, and it's a very interesting, ambitious game. But apparently the thing I wrote about it on RPS came across a bit negative to some of the people who made the game, which is not my intention at all. It calls itself an RPG, but I think that would probably conjure quite a lot of misleading ideas about what it is. It's a lot more about the physicality of combat than it is about stat building, although I believe that you will be able to kind of upgrade characters at some point. But it has a sort of top-down-ish view. It's what's often miscalled isometric these days, although it is in fact just 3D with foreshortening and everything you expect. But it has that kind of looking down at an angle kind of level. You're in an underworld, it seems. You awake with no memory. And don't really know what you're meant to be doing, but you go and run around and kill things and die, basically. But you kill things and die largely by the same process, which is entirely kind of one-to-one physics-modeled arm flailing. Like everything
in real life.
Although in real life, I think the emphasis for me would be on the dying rather than...
Yeah. Live by the arm flailing, die by the arm flailing.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, not just the arms, but also each individual footfalls have physics-y relevance. So, like, there's obviously a huge amount of effort has gone into creating the technology to have this system which not only articulates the kind of animations that you'd expect, but also, you know, has them interact in a really kind of subtle way with the environment and other physics-enabled objects. So you can kind of... It has a very unusual control scheme. So you kind of drag and click. You click and drag your mouse pointer away from your character. The further your mouse pointer is from the character, the faster they move towards that point in a beeline. There's no pathfinding or anything. So it does mean that you constantly have to kind of kite your character around with this mouse thing, which can be a bit of a problem because you also have to rotate the camera so you can see around corners and stuff. but which is largely fine, because you should approach the game with a huge amount of trepidation, because fights are nearly always lethal in my experience, but I'm not very good at it. And you switch to obviously kind of zombie-like dudes running around this dungeon, absolutely fucking terrifying to fight, because the combat system makes you feel it doesn't make you feel weak as such, because you can obviously master it and be very adept at killing things with it. But at the same time, the stakes are so much obviously higher when you can clip a table or something like that, fall over and be bludgeoned to death. You know, or you just mistime a swing, and it doesn't feel like it does in any other kind of brawler or RPG, where you can kind of just, you feel like your choices are available to you on a button press. Whereas in this, it really is like orchestrating a complex system just to kind of move your arm up over your shoulder, dodge to your right and parry, and, you know, bring a blade down into somebody's side while they can't actually deflect it with their own baton. That's super complicated to pull off in this. And because it has this kind of, austere learning curve, it means that the fights are truly fearful, and you spend most of your time running away from things and shutting doors on them. So you switch into a separate combat mode, and it changes the control scheme so that you click and swing your mouse cursor now to move your arm, but you can also use the WASD keys to kind of move yourself, but in relation to where your mouse cursor is. And I think it's obviously very, it allows for a huge amount of depth to the kinds of things you can do. But I think it is slightly in contradiction, directly in contradiction, because if you're moving your mouse cursor around to make sweeping blows, it's not ever going to be in the same place. So what WASD means, because it means something different relative to where your mouse cursor is, it's in constant flux. And I see why that's a kind of interesting thing to do, because it does mean that you have to be very purposeful and very thoughtful about your every move. But it also means that occasionally you will dodge to your left because you want to punch somebody, and you didn't want to dodge left. You know, and I don't think that replicates the same specific confusion that you might feel in a fight, although it does replicate the same kind of panic. And I don't know. I think it's interesting. Like, I wonder, I said this in one of the, in the captions, actually, that I think that maybe these games which have very heavy physics simulations, particularly with regards to combat and motion and movement, are going to go through a similar kind of awkward patch that motion-controlled games did on consoles, where it was kind of just assumed that because you'd have direct control over the motions of your characters, that was going to be better in some way, when in fact, actually, most of the time it felt just inefficient, or it was actually easier and better just to have, because the player's intent is better mapped to pressing a button and have your character just do something than it is to try and completely physically map the parameters of that gesture. And I think that's kind of true here, but also the combat is just about slow enough that it kind of creates a rhythm to it, which is perhaps alien to both real life combat and other games, but is its own thing, and that's probably okay. But anyway, it's very interesting, and like, there's going to be loads more to it. Apparently, it's a prelude, they say, to the a different game called Sui Generis. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I assume it's Latin. Sui, S-U-I, Sui, Sui. I can't remember. Anyway, Sui Generis, it was kickstarted a while ago, and it's a huge open-world RPG. And this is the standalone prelude to it, which backers also get. So I think it's also going to be quite a substantial game in its own right, all based in an underworld. At the moment, it seems like the devs say it would probably take you a few hours to run through if you knew what you were doing. I really don't know what I'm doing. And there's also no save feature in it at the moment. And it is hard as balls, as I've already mentioned. So it's going to take me infinity long to complete, I suspect, because it's just just got a massive learning curve on it. And I don't know if not having any save feature at all is a wise decision. I think the devs feel that that's what's right for their game. I think they thought about it and decided that's what they're going for, but I just think it means a lot of people won't see what's in their game. Which would be a shame, because as well as this combat system, they obviously have thought a lot about the world that it's taking place in. They have some kind of plot going on, which is more than normally interesting, and there's going to be, but there will be complex NPC interactions, they say, and dialogue, and these kind of, and, you know, richer kind of world interactions than just punching things. So I think it would be a mistake of the devs not to have some kind of checkpoint system or any way of kind of gating progress. I think there will be some kind of thing where you get a certain way through the game later on and it will create a new save point, but that's like several hours into the game, I think. I don't really want to play the first few hours again and again and again to get there. But, you know.
Totally, I was playing this earlier. And the combat system is interesting, but it felt so much worse than being a human. It, like, I'm playing this kind of weird puppet that is doing things at half the speed a human would do, and with like twice the bother. And so, for example, there's no thrust attack.
There will be, apparently.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So it's just this incredibly unintuitive way of moving your guy's arms around. To create the sense that you can't even aim at parts of the body or anything. There's no kind of ability to, you know, go over the guard or anything or go around things.
Oh, there is, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is a strange thing, because also you not only have your flailing, which is on the kind of mouse draggy stuff, but also you do have other bespoke kind of full attacks that are mapped to certain combinations of clicks and buttons. So you can actually double click and double click and hold, and it'll do an overhead strike.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is that control system is already kind of bursting at the seams, you know. I don't know where they're going to put the thrust in and what kind of combination of buttons that'll do, but it's a lot for anybody to mentally map. I don't think it's beyond the wit of man to learn that system by any means, and I probably would. And I think it does enough to kind of justify doing that. But I also think it's probably not the easiest way they could have generated the kind of feeling that they're going for.
There's definitely a very unique feeling to those bouts. There's a very unique sense of chaos, exciting chaos to it that I enjoyed, even though it is along the lines of kind of like a Gang Beasts.
Scimitory Dreams type.
Yeah.
Fast to it. But yeah, your point about the viewpoint being tied to your cursor is really important, because the way you decide where to slash from is that you drag the cursor back to over your shoulder and then you drag a slashing motion. And if for some reason like you hold down the mouse button slightly too late, then your character just does a 90 degree turn left, completely exposing all of his bowels to the enemy that stuff. And also, it means that if you're rotating around an enemy, which of course you are constantly because you're sidestepping, if your character is facing you, then left becomes right and right becomes left, essentially, because you're having to, like, that's a stupid layer of abstraction, which, as you say, a person in a fight would never have to reverse their own control scheme if they happen to be a different part of the room. So, you know.
It's weird, like, I think in pursuing simulation, they've actually simulated something which is not reality. But I do think I still quite like it, even though it's kind of its own thing.
Yeah, I really admire it, that it is trying to do this new thing. I craved a lock-on function, basically. Or maybe just I found myself mashing the space button, which resets the camera to behind your character, to try and just constantly reset my entire control scheme from being this complete, like, this incrementally shifting thing depending on where your cursor was. I'm looking forward to seeing how it develops. It feels like a very early stage of the plan anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah. I have had some amazing kind of just moments in it, though, which I don't think would have been created without that physics system. So there's a point very early on where you, it's not quite clear where you are. Everything appears to be kind of like barren storerooms. But I was in a storeroom, a barren storeroom, and there were just all these kind of planks and barrels laid up against the door. And you can just click on things in the environment and drag them, and you know, you have a physics interaction if you're close enough and pull them away. So I'm kind of unpicking this barricade, and I'm like, yay, physics! And I was like, there's probably something bad behind this door, behind this barricade. Whatever. So I open it, and you know, this guy kind of staggers through, and I try and shut the door, but the door won't shut because his face is in the way. And then I kind of just like, oh fuck, I've got to back off and, you know, get ready for a fight. So I do this, I back away. And, for some reason, because I think the zombies are kind of like, they're not all of them are instantly aggressive. This guy loses interest and wanders into a corner, so I was like, right, got his back to me, I'm gonna fucking clonk this guy, kind of shimmying up closer to him, and suddenly this woman just bursts through the door bellowing this giant fucking axe, and I'm tunneling over scenery on my chance, you know, attempt to escape, and then I'm just kind of kite them round all these kind of tables while stumbling over them and falling over and being, you know, hammered in the spine by a horrible axe, and finally get through the door and slam it shut, and I can hear them beating on the other side of the door wailing. And that was fucking terrifying. And it was only terrifying because I had moments in that which could not have been done without the physicism. Like, you see it all the time in horror films where the kind of protagonist is trying to escape the great bad guy, and of course they fall over something, and you know, there's the scrabbling on the floor as they try and get up as a kind of person approaches from behind, looming ever larger in the screen. And that was perfectly replicated by that, you know? Even though it was from this top-down perspective, it felt just, you know, I had, unlike a lot of the combat in the Leicester game, I did feel, for that moment, like a kind of much closer kind of sympathy with my, you know, avatar.
Mm.
But then, you know, then later I got my arm stuck in a barrel and stretched to like twice my length before twanging back like an elastic band. But that's fine. I also think that's fine. And, I think the developers slightly hurt that I mentioned that kind of stuff or seemingly mocked it in the article, but I didn't mean that in a bad way. Like, I enjoyed that, the kind of calamity of physics interaction as well. I think that's, you know, you it's have to embrace that.
Delightful chaos.
Yeah.
But my sword and board guy got his sword arm stuck behind his back.
Oh no.
For a long period of time. And, that was a really, really fun fight actually. trying to slash madly to unhook my arm behind my own back, just kind of like my shield just flinging out in front of me, and just kind of like desperately, like a, you know, hook like a Notre Dame, trying to flip his arm around. Very strange.
And you can stack naked bodies as well.
Wow!
You can strip them naked and stack them.
Box feature, right?
What you want in a game, isn't it? Really, stacking corpses.
I'm definitely going to play it again. I want to get further in the arena mode, which is one of the aspects of the early access build.
Oh yeah,
which I'll be quite enjoying.
Yeah, that's a good way to learning the combat system. In fact, it's probably better to play that first, just to get to grips with it, so you're not completely unprepared.
There's an interesting, like, your weapon choice does significantly change your, you know, obviously everything's physics models, having a giant hook seems to be one of the weapons, big great sword.
Yeah, there's like stats, I can't remember, it's not like poise or something like that, it's balance, I think. And obviously, like, a very large unwieldy weapon is going to throw you off balance. Like, if you try and swing a hammer, you're going to kind of wobble about all over the place. Like a big old weeble.
I love going into the arena with a giant fat dude in just pants.
Yes. Yeah, well, this is the thing. When I started, I thought I'd make a little tiny man like I am. But I was like, hang on, this is probably like a disadvantage, like it is in real life.
Yeah, you know? Short to reach, yeah.
Although, low centre of gravity could work out to your benefit.
That's true.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, but I went for a big fat dude, fat lady actually, in the arena, and that seems to do well.
Fat dude with an axe.
Yeah.
In a nappy, as he looks.
It's the dream.
That is my dream.
The dream.
Shall we do questions?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Left out the second half.
You're crazy. You're mixing it up.
We're entering a new era, man. Mm. You don't have to say that just because we said it in, like, episode 2.
I hold on to the old tradition, so, Chris.
I'm looking forward to the future.
We're in our 90s.
I'm the old blood. You're the new order.
Yeah. And this is our this is our dramatic reconstruction of the British election.
Read your question, Chris.
All right. Vanilla Nougar writes, dearest Creighton Crowbarristers, another tradition that struggles to find life in these the heady days of episode 91. It occurred to me recently that the surname of Sonic Games' main antagonist, Robotnik, was also the name given to the Czech serf class labouring under the oppressive Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is incidentally the greatest opening sentence of any question I think I've ever seen. If I recall correctly, The word entered popular vocabulary as the inspiration for robot and all the social commentary that comparison evokes. My point here is this. What are the implications of such a rich piece of culture as the word Robotnik being appropriated by a game which displays absolutely zero respect or even acknowledgement of its greater significance? Are there other examples, or is this an isolated phenomenon? I don't mean to come across as acrimonious or even necessarily offended in my question. I was just shocked by the way such a powerful historical artifact could be so divorced from any context or meaning. Love to hear your thoughts. Keep potting the cat. Vanilla Nougat. Of course, you've got to stress that Robotnik was only called Robotnik in Europe. He was called Eggman everywhere else. And as far as I know, Eggman is not a historically loaded term. Although, where did the Beatles...
Oh, I don't know. The Wars...
Yeah. You know, perhaps his use of the name Eggman in North America and I presume in translation in Japan is a guarded reference to the Beatles and therefore suggesting that perhaps Paul Sonic McCartney is dead. I don't know.
Sonic was meant to be a walrus all this time. It's really badly drawn.
I think I was thinking about this because I was wondering if I wonder if this is a case of actually sort of going through the same thing backwards because. I don't imagine the translators of Sonic the Hedgehog, when deciding to call Dr. Robotnik Dr. Robotnik, were making a deliberate reference of any kind.
No, it seems like there's kind of a combination of words and sounds that might go together, really.
Yeah.
You know, just by luck, sounds similar to something that actually does exist.
He's an evil doctor that has an army of robots, hence robot.
Mm.
He wears a lot of red, and, you know, this is the... immediately post-Soviet era in history when adding Nick to his name might, you know, conjure a desired effect of some kind.
Mm.
So, hence Robotnik. Alternatively, you know, Dr. Robotnik is known for trapping small animals, the true people of the Sonic universe, in robots. Perhaps in a on-the-nose but deliberate metaphor for a Czech surf class under the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And we're just not looking deep enough into the lore. Like, you know, perhaps by being called Dr. Robotnik, which actually frames him in a strange way. He's the oppressor, yet he takes the name of the oppressed. Perhaps it's a gesture at the appropriation of the revolutionary mechanism by those in power to prevent further, further advancement in workers' rights. I don't know, is the answer.
Culprit PhD in the making. Yeah, exactly. Anybody listen to this? Cha-ching, that's money for the arts humanities.
In Sonic the Comic, he was originally a good doctor called Dr. Kinterbore, and then he got hit by goo, and his name went backwards, because that's what happens when you're evil.
Is this true?
Yeah, no, this is Sonic the Comic. I read this when I was 8 years old. Wow. So therefore, it's true. So, yeah, in many ways, is it? Don't know.
Is Sonic the bourgeois in this? What's the...
Well, Sonic, if we're going with this Sonic the Comic version of this origin story, the same, like, goo explosion that turns kindly Dr. Kinterbore into evil Dr. Robotnik also turns the slow brown hedgehog in his lab into a fast blue hedgehog called Sonic. But I believe that backstory has since been... I think I maybe just was specific to the British comic. I don't know. And to this point in my life, I got through 27 years without really caring, but
maybe Sonic the Hedgehog is a kind of Dark Soulsian epic where this detail is hidden in the environment and no one was really capable of putting it out until we decided to go on this tangent.
I mean, his objectives are merely to acquire Chaos Emeralds, which it's implied he himself can't really use except to make bigger robots, whereas Sonic is uniquely capable of, and his friends. Anyone with shoes, basically, in that universe is uniquely capable. Any animal with shoes is uniquely capable of taking advantage of the power of the Chaos Emeralds to turn into super versions of themselves. At this point...
Is ownership of shoes, like, a metaphor?
It is something that separates Sonic from all the other animals in that world, yeah. I mean,
acquisition of property.
Yeah, potentially. They're also taller, suggesting that they're better fed. Again, maybe indicating somewhat that the... You know, the political agency is ultimately handed off to the middle classes at the expense of the working classes in the event of a powerful hegemony.
Hegemony, brilliant.
Oh, fuck.
I think what this entire discussion has proved is that Dr. Robotnik being called Dr. Robotnik is so bereft of context that you couldn't possibly, like, it almost can't be offensive because anyone playing that game is just not going to derive a political message from it. So it's almost just this becomes a silly word that's detached from language.
It was, by the time like Sonic Adventure came out, he was Eggman officially. By the time those games were voice acted, he was Eggman, not Dr. Robotnik. But by that point as well, those games had human characters, which further problematizes who the talking superpowered animals are in a world that also has regular humans. So
some of whom they have romantic relationships with, which is fucking weird.
It is, it's weird. It's weird for you and I, Marsh, but it's not weird for a lot of the internet for the last 15 to 20 years. Which, I mean, it speaks to nothing else other than everyone's aspirational desire to join the middle classes by marrying a hedgehog.
Yeah. Hedgehog money.
Can you think about
takeaway?
Other examples of this happening? not specifically this.
We're banging knuckles.
No, where, you know, an appropriation of a word has, eradicated its original meaning. Franz Ferdinand tried to do that, didn't they? Quite explicitly with their band name.
I'm trying to think of really gaming one. I mean, there's been plenty of, like, sort of, like, you know, political readings of Mario in his, you know, presentation, but I don't really kind of think there's anything particularly.
No.
There's a good, I can't remember whether it was a video or an article, but there's a good, you know, attempt to kind of explain the politics of the Mushroom Kingdom.
Oh,
as a political enterprise, which is kind of interesting.
I didn't mean political readings. I meant where one word has been appropriated by games, thus obliterating its original meaning. One of the things that always, when I was writing Fridge, they had to, obviously they have a star guide, as all magazines do, but they had an insistence in using the word reticule instead of reticle. And reticule is a handbag. But I don't know who wrote the style guide, but we obeyed it nonetheless, wincing each time we used the word reticule.
Your handbag. Center your handbag on the enemy.
Indeed, yeah. I can't think of any. Obviously, plenty of games appropriate global political context for the purposes of very trivial man shoots, which they probably shouldn't do. But in terms of like a single word,
this is a unique case of a very specific political term being appropriated by a game for no apparent reason. normally it would be Call of Duty to do something incredibly ham-fisted with it, right?
Yeah, to produce a travesty.
Yeah,
against history.
Whereas this is either brilliant subversive political messaging by the Sega Europe translation team, or completely arbitrary chance.
It's just like a Final Fantasy boss being called Mr. Bolshevik. It's just really, it's so strange.
I remember having a German friend explain to me the sort of population, the why that so many German words cropped up in Japanese, in manga and games and fiction and things.
They love the German language.
I think it has something to do with 20th century historical context, but I don't want to say it's actually the Second World War and German influences on Japan during the Second World War, because I don't know if it's certain.
I read somewhere that it was a some kind of linguistic
fondness.
The vowel sounds or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of like Zwei and like Herzog Zwei being called what it is, I think, for that reason as well. Which is of course a game where you play two Werner Herzogs. Yeah, not to be confused with double Herzog.
Yeah. The Herzog.
Yeah. Werner the Herzog.
The ruler of his own Herzogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogogog
I think I've heard that before somewhere, but I still love that idea so much. Actually, that was someone made.
I think there's an image of it. Isn't
yeah, someone made the splash screen for Sonic the Hedgehog 2, but with Werner the Herzog 2. Werner Herzog interviews Dr. Robotnik. I would.
We need that. Watch
that. You see a lot of religious concepts repurposed, especially Christian ideas, just really like ham-fistedly taken into weird kind of fantasy lore scenarios, angels, devils, that kind of thing. The spell in the Final Fantasy games is just called Holy, which is just a giant nuke that comes down from the sky, and it's the sense that it's holy in some way, like holy. It's strange.
Is it actually a nuke, or is it?
No, it's giant beams of light that can explode.
Mm.
It's very exciting, but it's just called, it's holy, and then you upgrade it, it's holy one, holy two, sorry, and holy three, I think. Upgrade it enough, you get a new holy. It's just a, it's a very, very strange use of the word. It feels like it's a translation.
Something I've always liked about Dragon Age and its writing is that it does quite a good job of presenting, I mean, its central religion is heavily based on Christianity, but it actually gets what it's doing with that and uses it as a way of commenting on shifts in that religion and a certain way it approached gender and blasphemy and a few other things. Like, it's very conscious, let's take some of the ideas about the historical shifts that took place in Christianity and apply them to a world that has wizards in it and that has all those other things. You know, it's Christianity where, what if the empire that Jesus was fighting back against was an empire of wizards and Jesus was female, and that's and the subsequent effects it has in society. And so that's an example of real life political ideas being adopted into a game for commentary and actually working, I think. It's comparatively pretty rare because paladins are cool. Michael Coolthirst writes, "Dear Fishboxes and Birdsticks, are QTEs ever acceptable? And as the answer to the previous question is no, why do games keep using them? Did Dragon Lair teach us nothing? Relatedly, in the newish Tomb Raider, are the player's misery at having to repeatedly hammer arbitrary keys in response to arbitrary on-screen prompts reflecting the misery that the game wallows in, and the player's RSI pain as they hammer those keys echoing the pain gleefully inflicted on Lara at any opportunity? Are these," so he's asking, "are these things examples of ludonarrative consonance?"
Do we drink?
I guess
what's the opposite of drink?
He says undrink. So I guess we just vomit into our cupped hands now. Or just bad design married to unskippable torture porn. Thanks for reading, everybody. Michael. P.S. Having to hammer E to open doors and boxes is just dickishness.
That X enema, you actually open the doors, you know, physically. You can click and drag them. And they're kind of OP, really, because the enemies can't go through them, so you can kind of open a door, go, ah! Slam it closed again.
Like being cruel to a dog.
Yes, but there's something cool about that. I quite like the fact that it's not just a button press, that you have kind of analog control over it, because you kind of creak it open. You know, what's going to be on the other side is the thing, Sam.
Divinity Original Sin had a good line in actually physically manipulating and moving things around you. That's really, really fun.
We're not really talking about QTEs at that point. We're talking about physical manipulable.
No.
Physically.
It's that time of the podcast.
Physically manipulating objects in the environment.
Yeah, I think QTEs are always rubbish.
Something I became really freshly aware of when playing Wolfenstein, and this is a thing in the original game, is, as well, but in Old Blood particularly, is the amount you spend pressing E. Because that game doesn't have any automatic pickup for loot items. And if you're playing a decent clip, and I always play it on like the second penultimate difficulty, so like not the hardest, but the one just below that, because I think it's probably not the sweet spot for that game. You know, BJ Baskovitz is a man who hoovers up health packs and dog food to stay alive in the middle of a gunfight. Yeah. Helmets, just piling on helmets, ripping armor off dogs, bolting that to himself, plucking grenades out of the mouths of skeletons and using them. And so your E is not just your pickup button, which is fine. It's, and there's some context sensitive stuff. So if you're about to pick up a gun, it's the same as the one you've already got. You can hold E to then subsequently dual wield them. So there are moments when you'd have to think about it. But for the most part, the E button just becomes the don't die button. And so as you're running around shooting and doing everything else, you really should be looking out for the loot and just hammering E.
Well, it's all over the place in those environments as well. So you literally just kind of go da 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 da.
Yeah. And later on, you can get actually one thing I do like about it that changes from the New Order is it has the same upgrade system where you can kind of unlock things, but it's based on doing stuff. So it's all kind of like mini invisible micro achievements give you new things. And one of the upgrades I got was it's actually called like Bash Reload or something, but allows you to bash R to reload faster, which I think is supposed to give you the feeling of panic reloading, but I don't think it really works, because if you compare it to, like, I like games that experiment with having faster ways for you to reload if you're skillful. Like Gears of War famously had the active reload thing, which is an idea I'm surprised more people haven't nicked, because it creates a really strong sense of expertise when you pulled it off, but also when you fucked it up and your gun jammed, it felt like there was a clear cause and effect between your fucking it up and the physical consequences in the game. Whereas just hammering a button doesn't really mirror what BJ is doing.
Hmm.
You know, like, he's removing a clip and putting the clip back in. And it just plays that animation faster if you hammer the key. Whereas there are more elegant ways of doing that, I think. And it's an example of, like, where more interaction isn't better. It's where you feel more attached to the character that you're pressing the key more often, because you're still pressing a key.
Yeah,
not like actually reloading a gun.
Weird wall climbing sections where you can alternately hold down the mouse buttons to move like little bits of broken pipe.
He loves that pipe.
But it's just kind of like, well, I can do it, but
I
like,
can
just
see
let
that
me
working
go on the wall.
Better with triggers. I can see that being designed to hold one trigger, then hold the other trigger.
Yeah, it doesn't really feel right with the mouse buttons at all. But even with triggers, you're just like, well, there's only one way to do it. Mm. I'm going to do it because it's not hard. So just have it done automatically, you know, if you really... It just feels like it's an interaction for the sake of interaction without providing any choice within that at all.
Mm.
Which is one of the problems of the game as a whole, I think.
When you fuck it up, it doesn't feel like it's your fuck up, really. Like, it doesn't feel like something you would fuck up. It's just you didn't quite get the cadence of the alternating clicks quite right, and so BJ fell off a wall, which doesn't feel like something he would do, something what you weren't intending to do. Like, it's not skill-based interaction, really. And you never have to climb in an environment where you're escaping somebody or you're getting shot at, so you need to kind of, you know, demonstrate your expertise in order to get away with more health or whatever, because these moments are always aside from combat encounters, so why have an interaction there? There's a... QTEs in general, I God knows why they're still around, other than they're cheap and they look good in trailers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. We've discussed at length how much we hate QTEs. I think back around the time that Tomb Raider was released, we discussed it actually. So maybe if you want a longer and more sweary answer, you can go back and listen to those episodes.
There's an amazing screen grab or photo doing the rounds of a page from the, like, Primer strategy guide or whatever, you know, whatever guide for the Order 1866, which is a PlayStation exclusive, you know, 4-hour long,
cutscene shooter,
where whoever the poor sod that got hired to do the, you know, magazine length guide for that 4-hour incredibly linear game, dedicated a whole page to a QTE that only had like two button inputs on it, and the picture of that page is the most depressing thing.
Watch the cutscene and press X when prompted.
When it says X on the screen, press X. And then it like describes the next bit of action, because, you know, like, continue to watch this, allow the light to enter your eyes and the sound to enter your ears. Process this information.
But before no critical thought whatsoever, ideally.
Feel excitement for no real good reason. And I have shuffled onto the wrong page of questions, and will therefore shuffle back to the beginning, because I've confused myself. Entertain yourselves, listeners. And I've arrived. There's only 3 pages, so it's amazing that took quite so long. Dave Goldberg writes...
Who this?
Dave Goldberg.
Oh, right. Right, sorry.
Sorry, was
I thought you said Gog my Gog. I was thinking that's such a good surprising reference. Sorry, Dave Goldberg. It's quite a different
name. And I'm sorry for saying that wrong. Hi, Creighton Cro-Magnons. I'm sure somebody has already used that. Sorry for unoriginality. A few episodes ago, he's a bit behind. Someone, Chris, he says, and yes, Chris, he's right, it is me. I'll continue. Said that WoW had created the first instance dungeon. I have to correct that, because one of my favourite parts of EverQuest was Lost Dungeons of EverQuest, which had timed instance dungeons more than a year before World of Warcraft was released. LDON was what kept me going in EverQuest. In some ways, it was better than the dungeons in WoW, because it was timed. It was a Mission Impossible setup, where you were given a mission and had 90 minutes to do it. It kept you moving and enjoyed the got it AFK for a while syndrome. It was a huge leap forward from the usual sit-in-one-place-and-grind experience gameplay. As I recall, the experience rewards were enormous. At the lower levels, you got 10 to 20% of level just for one 90-minute dungeon run. Anyway, back to enjoying the sun after 6 months of winter. It's pretty nice here in the northeast USA. So yeah, he is right that, like, the concept of instancing off a part of the world for a few players to do did exist in MMOs before WoW. In my defense, I think this came up in a discussion about... It might have been even Galaxies or something. It was definitely about the way that WoW redefined a genre by coming along and redefining what that genre even meant. Similarly, on a similar notion, before WoW was released, instancing was technology. And you'd say an instance to refer to technology that was a developer's disposal. I don't think anyone really thought of the Lost Dungeons of EverQuest as instances. That word gained all of its meaning in WoW. And it, you know, now when you say instance, what you mean is a WoW instance. So he's perfectly right that people had used that technology to create game experiences prior to World of Warcraft. But it was World of Warcraft that created the concept of the instance, which is a, you know, a dungeon encounter with bosses separated by trash mobs that you go in normally with five people, and you get loot at these intervals, and you get XP at these intervals, and maybe later games added jumping puzzles and stuff. I defend my point by saying that while he's right, the whole kind of, the broader point I was making about WoW totally setting in stone what that genre is, even affected ideas that had maybe had little vestigial expressions in other games, but then gained their meaning in WoW. Whereas subsequently, when people say, how many instances does like this game have? They don't mean, how many timed dungeon challenges does this game have? They mean, how many WoW-style instances does it have?
So fuck you, is what Chris is trying to say.
No, that's absolutely not what I'm trying to say. And I'd be mortified if he took that away, that impression. Do you ever wonder why developers might misread some of the praise you have for their games, Martin?
No, I don't understand that at all. I'm a bundle of joy, firing out beams of laughter and happiness.
You almost cracked up on happiness then. That's all the self-reflection we have time for, and indeed all the questions we have time for.
Send us more questions, if you will, or for answering on a later date. You can do that by sending them to questions@creatingcrowbar.com. Or you can write them on the forum, if you like. Or you can tweet them to @creatingcrowbar, the forum, incidentally, which you should visit and talk on, because there's lots of nice people there. So creatingcrowbar.com/forum. And we are, individually, should you wish to follow us on Twitter. Who are you, Chris?
I'm @cthurston, CTHURSTEN.
Tom Senior, who are you?
@PCGLudo, which is L-U-D-O.
I'm Marsh Davis. It's D-A-V-I-E-S.
Oh. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bringing back the old ways there, Marty.
That's right. Don't want to shake things up.
Don't rock that boat.
No.
Let me be abundantly clear. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Hello and welcome to episode 91 of the Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming...
podcast failure detected.